Okay. Chapter 2, Freedom from the Slavery of Self-Love. The goal of asceticism is to divest ourselves of the old man within, to divest as if the old man were a vestment. And it applies, it makes sense too, because a vestment is not part of ourselves. We are not by nature the way the old Adam was. It can be taken off and thrown away. We don't need it. It's hard for us to believe because we, in the last chapter, Elder Paisios was talking about taking off ourself and throwing it away. We don't need it. We don't need to be looking in the mirror and seeing ourselves and admiring ourselves and thinking, that's me. I remember at the University of Washington, a particular insight that came, it didn't come to me unaided. In fact, I was helped by someone that I wouldn't have expected, and that was a famous feminist, not in the flesh, but in a book. I would haunt these bookstores. And there was this famous feminist, if I really racked my brain, I might be able to remember her name, but I think I won't bother. At any rate, it was an introduction to her book. She was a philosophical woman, very, very bright, very sharp. And she pointed out something that I've seen pointed out in other ways, other places, but what we call the self does not exist until reflection. The self is the same thing as the sort of thing we see when we look in a mirror. What we see in the mirror is an image. What another woman, a great woman, philosopher, who Suzanne Langer, Dr. Suzanne Langer, who I learned a great deal from many, many years ago, by way of books again, not in the flesh. Langer would call that the virtual image. What we see in a mirror is a virtual image. You know, it's virtual. You know, now we have computers since then, since those days long ago. And we know not about virtual reality. And for a lot of people, virtual reality is the reality that they live within most of the time, by way of a computer, by way of computer games, by way of those rectangular screens that Benjamin was talking about up at the monastery the other day. You know, one kind of rectangular screen or another, whether it's a computer or a television or an iPhone or whatever it happens to be. And what you see in there is virtual reality, not the real thing. On a more positive note, another place that I ran into this in a way that I thought was especially strong was when we recently, Sharon and I, rewatched Pinocchio, one of the true classic Walt Disney films. And one thing led to another, and I ended up looking at a famous book that was written by the artists, the collection of great animation artists that worked for Disney in those days. And a book was written that kind of summarized all of their experiences from before Snow White, beyond Pinocchio to Peter Pan. And the book was called Imitation of Life. Imitation of Life. Because they worked so hard, you know. I don't know if you've ever seen a presentation, as I have, when we were young people back in the 60s and Walt Disney, A Wonderful World of Color was on TV. Periodically, they would have a program where they went behind the scenes and showed you all they went through in order to accomplish the kind of animation that they did. We take animation for granted today because we have computers and there's computer animation, but there was an incredible amount of work that they went to make sure that every movement, every expression of the characters that they created in Snow White and Pinocchio and the great classics of those early years was exactly lifelike. Imitation of life, so that when you watch them, feel like you're watching something that is real. It's an imitation of life. Well, those are virtual images. They're not real, okay? We experience them as real. We experience the adventures that these characters have as real. We participate in them. We respond to them emotionally. And this virtual image, virtual is it's like real, but it's not real. That's what our self is. The self that we love, the self that we serve, the self that we idolize, it's no more than the image in a mirror. If you turn off the light, you can't see that image, but then that image is burned into your mind, into your consciousness, into your imagination, and that's who we think we are, and it isn't. this virtual image, this old man. It's not our true self. And the goal of asceticism is to take off the vestment of that old self, to take off the virtual image of pride and vanity and all the rest of those things, so that we can live without it. We don't need it. We don't need it. We will still be the person that God created. We have all we need in order to be able to participate in God's holiness and goodness actively, without letting this virtual image come between us and God. We start to take the credit for goodness and decency and qualities that aren't even our own. They're God's qualities. You remember the young man that came to Christ and called him good master, good teacher. And Jesus told him, only God is good. Only God is good. The good that we are, the good that we have by participation with him. With him. Even if we don't realize it, we think we have good qualities, you know, and we're proud of them. But they're not our qualities. They're divine. We only share them by being sufficiently humble to be good and decent and let God's divinity find a place in our actions in the world. So that's how we can be. Instead of that, we are enslaved by a love of this image of ourselves that we have of ourselves. It would be bad enough if the image that we had of ourselves were a matter of admiring all of the good qualities that we enact but actually belong to God. But with self-love, we start acting different from God. And we still love ourselves. We love ourselves in our vanity. We attribute all these good things to you know, when we are good, you know, to ourselves. And asceticism is about gaining our freedom from that slavery to our self-image, to self-love. And St. Paisios says here on page 50, overcome self-love by bearing a remark or injustice. This is how you do it. Not by doing any kind of great heroic act. We might have the sense that if I am compassionate and do something nice for somebody else, I'm overcoming self-love. But chances are we're going to feel good about ourselves because we did something for somebody. So we really want to strike the knife into our self-love. Overcome self-love by bearing a remark or injustice. Instead of saying, it's not just that this person said this about me, me. See, it's me. Me is this self. It's this act of pointing to yourself. It's the act of reflection. It's not a fair thing to say about me. And then your finger comes and it points to yourself. That's the same kind of reflection on yourself. When you're reflecting about yourself, it is unjust that you say this about me. And that me, it's like comes into existence, like a projection. Like in Star Wars, you know, when Princess Leia, you know, is projected by R2-D2. She's not really there, okay? This is unjust that you say this about me and we project this image of ourselves. Look at me, I'm not like that. And we're thinking about this self-image that doesn't actually exist. And add to this humbling of ourselves and bearing an unjust remark, just a little physical effort out of love and goodwill. And then God helps. And we're able to act with this freedom of a loss of self-love, being constantly conscious of how resentful of how others are not treating us appropriately. What do physical effort and asceticism have to do with cutting off the passions? Yoranda. We learned how to pronounce Yoranda the other week. Yoranda, what do physical effort and asceticism have to do with cutting off the passions? Because after all, passions are not physical. Physical effort subjects the body to the spirit. It puts the body under the spirit. The spirit has chosen to make physical effort. Fasting and vigils and every ascetic practice. Vigils are difficult. We had a short vigil this past weekend up at the monastery. You know, that was a short vigil, don't you think? Compared to some of the vigils that we went to on the Holy Mountain, mm-hmm. that was only 3 hours. Yeah. You know, we've done six. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Watch the sun come up. Gradually you get light from the outside, you know, at some point. Mm-hmm. You know, 4 or 5 hours into the vigil, the sun starts to come up.
16 hours sometimes.
And if you're really celebrating hard, because that's how you celebrate in a monastery,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Physical effort subjects the body to the spirit. Fasting and vigils and every ascetic practice, when done out of love for Christ, we could build up a lot of vanity by doing those vigils. Think how tough we are, that sort of thing. And along with love of Christ, and along with, in conjunction, together with, the struggle to cast out the passions of the soul. If one does not struggle to uproot the passions of the soul, pride, envy, anger, and practices only bodily asceticism, he will nurture his passions with pride. So it has to be for Christ. Now, for Christ is not, I am doing this for Christ, you know, and you raise your sword and you have the red cross on your chest and chainmail and all, I'm going into battle for Christ. There's a lot of pride involved here. It's not that. If it's for Christ, it is self-emptying. Kenosis. If it's for Christ, it is self-emptying. If it fills you up with pride, you know, then it's not for Christ. It's for yourself. People can go to the Holy Mountain and have experiences that they really think are wonderful, and they're filled with themselves. They're not self-emptying experiences. So they're not for Christ. They're for self-glorification. Mm-hmm. Elder Paisios, St. Paisios, is very kind here to me. Oh, this was so sweet of him to say. And to you too, Sharon.
Oh,
the body's extra weight is less harmful than the passions of the soul. Isn't that encouraging? No? I think it's encouraging. A profound comment. The first is benign. Benign. Extra weight. Benign. Imagine. I've not read this in other spiritual texts. So this is a, you know, this is a, whereas the others, the passions of the soul, are malignant. Malignant. In other words, if a tumor is malignant, it'll kill you. Or at least it threatens to. It needs to be seriously dealt with. It's not inevitable, but it needs serious treatment, right? It needs to be excised and, you know, shoot things at it that will make it get smaller. And that's what we need to do in our spiritual effort.
Is benign the...
Benign is it's not bad, not good, yeah. It's just there.
Okay.
Like a tumor. Mm-hmm. It's, oh, and they say, well, it's benign. It doesn't mean it's good for you. It's just not good for you, it's not bad for you, it's just there, it's just a lump.
In a place where it's not doing any damage.
Yeah, you might not even take it out. You might take it out because you never know. It might become malignant. But right now it's just a lump. You know. And overweight, or being overweight, it can become malignant as well. You know. I mean, spiritually malignant. It might become physically malignant and dangerous to you before it becomes spiritually malignant. I'm not sure. They may run together, as a matter of fact. By the time you're critically obese and about to die from eating, I have a suspicion that passions are involved.
Definitely. You don't have to be that far along for passions to be involved.
That's true. Okay. He says he's not saying that you shouldn't practice asceticism. Bodily asceticism. What I'm saying is, one should come to an understanding of asceticism that it has as its goal the divesting of the old man within. It's not a physical culture routine to improve your physique. Yoronda. Oh, we're saying it right now. Imagine, Yoronda. Greeks would hear, they would clap for us if they heard us say Yoronda. Yoronda, how should one struggle for abstinence? Struggle requires the following. First, provide your body with whatever it needs. No more. Start with just providing it with what it needs. That's already very tough. It's disappointing to us who enjoy food how little the body actually needs. The parts you enjoy, I don't think that it needs that. You certainly don't need to enjoy your food in order to be able to keep yourself together, unfortunately. You just need something that's You don't need to eat monkey chow, but... Okay, then, after you provide the body with what it needs, then aim at cutting off your spiritual passions, desires, egoism, envy, so forth. Afterward, exercise more abstinence in food and sleep. No, that's maintenance project. Maintain food and sleep. Okay.
I guess you have to kind of be testing to find out what your body needs, don't you?
Later on in the chapter, he talks about how you should need a review every once in a while. Stephen remembers that too, right?
Yeah.
Review.
Yeah, check, see how things are going.
Just like what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. We'll come across it. Page 52, second paragraph. Yoranda, when I feel exhausted, I'm faint-hearted, I'm overcome, I can't do anything. Is this self-love? So he explains to her, how do I understand, how to tell one way or the other. Whenever you feel exhausted, assess whether you're ill. If your exhaustion is not caused by an illness, it's okay, I'm not sick. Then check to see if it's due to not enough sleep, or if you need to eat and rest a little more. If it's none of those, then it's a matter of temptation. Sloth, right? Get up, begin your work, and you will prevail over the temptation. It's remarkable how well this prescription works, not just on sloth, but also on acedia, you know.
Acedia?
Acedia, yeah. What was acedia, people remember? From last week? Time before last, I guess. It's despondency.
Yes.
Being despondent. So I'm despondent. What do? I'm despondent. I'm so despondent. Get up and do something. There must be something you need to do. You know, make a short list of all the things that need to be done and then pick out the one that is most needs to be done most immediately and get to busy on it. Once you get busy on it, then probably your acedia, your despondency will go away.
You said that one was worse than despair?
Yeah. Worse than despair. Death. It's death-like. Because there's no cause for it. Remember?
No cause.
And no virtue that is the opposite of it, unlike most temptations. And if you try to distract yourself, run away from it, it won't help, because there will be more acedia, more despondency, because instead of dealing with it, you've run away from it by turning to distraction. So you get up, you do something needs to be done, you know, make a contribution to God's universe. And maybe your house, or the people depend on you, the people you share a home with. Do something for somebody else. Do something for all of you together. Something significant, something important. Turn your energy and your mind to the doing of something. That's different than just trying to distract yourself, you know.
Sounds like hope being on level zero.
Who? Hope. Well, Sharon, I think, helped make the distinction between acedia and despair by saying that despair... And with despair, the problem is lack of hope. No, there are things you can do, you know, about that as well. Okay, bottom of the page. The more one sits, the more slack he is. The more one works, the more strengthened he is. So we sit around all the time, watching TV, playing video games, become more and more slack. The more we work, the stronger we get. We can't stand to not work. We wanted to be doing something. People like that never get bored. They always, you know, there's always something that needs to be done. I mean, the world is not so perfect that work is not necessary. Work not only gets rid of the moldiness, it also helps one spiritually. The goal, top of page 53, is for one to reach the point of rejoicing more for a life of hardships than for a life of ease. No gain without pain, right? True of the body, true of the spiritual life as well. Mm-hmm. Hardships. Bring anything to mind? Go ahead.
I was just saying, it seems terrible if you hate doing the works, but I've learned that if you just do them and don't listen to the negative thoughts about them, then you won't. You won't hate them anymore.
Yeah, Jesus' prayer is nice when you're doing physical labor, as long as it's not anything that mind needs to be paying close attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Like when they were trying to teach me how to run a milling machine. And, well, it was Singer. Singer was the name of the company, but they weren't making sewing machines. They were making knitting machines. And these knitting machines had a huge, as part of the machine, had a huge, about probably 4 feet across, piece of probably not solid steel, but there was steel. It was a compound of some sort, but it was metal. It was really heavy. The whole thing probably weighed, I don't know, 500 pounds. It was very, very heavy. Anyway, it was a massive thing on this machine that a little tool came down and it milled the surface of it flat. It had to be perfectly flat across the top. And I'm not very good at very small increments on a dial. My eyes are not that good anyway. I can easily miss a couple zeros. A couple zeros can make a big difference. So if you set the dial so that instead of taking 1/100,000th off, you're taking 1/100th, it will dig into that piece of close to 500 pound thing, and it will come off of the machine and fly through the air and kill somebody. In my case, wow. They shut down the machine before this piece left the machine. But the guy who was teaching me, I never saw a man look that white. He's the whitest looking man I ever saw in my life. You know, he was the color of a sheet, you know. It looked like a ghost. You know, I was very impressed.
Wow.
And he also was impressed. And never again did I get to flip the switch on that machine and turn it back on again. They moved me somewhere else, you know. So I didn't have the opportunity to do that again.
Machine.
So probably not a good place to say the Jesus prayer. Probably a good place to play perfect, unless you happen to be trying to teach this idiot how to run the machine. It's probably a good thing for Homer to say the Jesus prayer. You know, with me at the machine. But I needed to be paying attention to that dial. I needed not just my body, but all of the faculties of my mind and eyes that I obviously did not have, you know, good enough eyes. So sometimes is not the best time to play. But then on the other hand, there was no boredom going on there. There was no despondency. You know, people were totally engaged in the work that was going on. The work was completely engaging. Not the best time for the Jesus prayer. There are times that aren't the best time.
Sounds like a dangerous machine.
Well, it is, and it was in my hands. You know, it was in my hands. But if you're shoveling gravel or something, excellent time for the Jesus prayer. Or if you're doing yard work, unless you happen to be pushing heavy equipment, you might want to, you know, be more careful there. Okay. Second paragraph, page 54, in the middle of that paragraph. The fathers threw away their own self and found it in the hands of God. So you get who you are back. You don't have to worry about losing who you are, which is what we're worried about. We're so proud of ourselves, so much in love with ourselves, we just feel like this self needs maintenance. And it does if your self is all a matter of self-glorification and pride and vanity, and that needs to be maintained and it needs to be served. Other people need to serve it. You try to get them to do it. Hey, aren't I great? Look at me. This is pretty terrific. I'm the most important one. You stand over here. Look, I am the central person here, right? Well, that doesn't just happen by itself, but you don't need that. It doesn't add to anything. It doesn't make you better at what you do. You can throw it away, you know, and you find that our true selves are hidden in Christ, as St. Paul would say. Middle of the next paragraph. We complain over the slightest trial. We seek to acquire holiness without any effort. Good things are acquired with effort, according to an ancient Greek saying. Good things are acquired with effort. We are lenient with ourselves, justifying ourselves, making excuses for everything we do, because after all, everything I do is excellent. And if it's not, I'll tell you why. Well, here's the problem. It was probably this person or that person or insufficient materials or something happened that it wasn't up to the usual standard of my absolute perfection, you know. And that's the reason. There's always an excuse. I can justify it because after all, I am the greatest at this. This is the point where evil begins. The devil himself also finds justifications. He will feed us all the self-justification we need. And so the years pass, and we stay the same way.
Ooh.
Since we are to die, we should not worship comfort. Comfort should not be. We have a limited period of time in this life. A limited period of time as a young person, a limited period of time as a middle-aged person, and a even more limited period of time as old people. Only old people only get so old, and then they're gone, you know. So we need to be about.
Right now, it's around 116.
You think you're going to live to 116?
No, it's about
the absolute ridiculous max. How many people live to be that old?
Not too many.
How about 90?
Right now in the United States, you're getting...
It's fairly common.
You're getting more and more people to be in there.
Of course, we're not in great shape either.
No, not necessarily us, but some other people.
I'm diabetic. I have a pacemaker.
I don't know.
I'm obese.
The statistics say that not many people die over 90.
Yes,
because they're already dead. Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. Okay. Yoranda, top of page 55, I think that perhaps it is not my limited endurance that causes me to tire easily, but rather something else. Yes, if the divine flame were within you, then everything would have been different. We would have energy. Look at these old, emaciated monks, elderly, you know, men and elderly women, and they're full of energy. Where does it come from? Not from their excellent physique. It comes from the divine flame that is within them. So, Yoranda, how can I acquire that divine flame? By forgetting your own self and thinking of others. So we participate in God's love of others. Not that we're going to be so great because now I am so great that I love others. No, we participate in God's love of others. You know, share in the goodness of God. You will gradually come to the point of becoming indifferent to yourself. It doesn't make any difference, all that self-love. And so we're busy, we're in the business of doing what needs to be done for others. You will be indifferent to yourself in the good sense, not in the bad sense of not caring what happens to me. It doesn't matter, I'm just a disgusting human being. And no, God doesn't create disgusting human beings. He creates human beings that are made in his image and are meant to be like him, you know. So in the good sense, you become indifferent to your selfish love of yourself, and you're able to fulfill our calling as human beings to be like God and always think of others. Last paragraph. Yoranda, how will I throw away my own self? As much as you can, take your own self out of your actions and put others into yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. That's part of what it means. And we do the opposite. We put ourselves into our actions. We get something out of it for ourselves. Even things that we ought to do, that we need to do, we'll take something for ourselves, you know. Most of the examples I can think of have to do with being a parent. But, you know, like when you're angry and you need to discipline your children. But you shouldn't discipline your children out of anger, because when you're angry then you're justified in doing something disciplinary, you're taking something out of it for yourself, because your anger is getting a selfish boost out of it, and it's not you know,
affirmation.
Yeah, yeah, affirmation, right.
I can think of one without
parenting. Okay, go ahead.
Picking blueberries from the bush.
Yeah, how's that work?
You see, this is for the pie for the people later, but I'm going to eat some too.
And right. This pie gets smaller and smaller, mm-hmm, instead of bigger and bigger.
No, you have to taste a few of those blueberries.
Make sure they're good.
Yeah.
Well, eat the green ones.
No. Leave the green ones on.
Give without considering your own self. The more you give, the more you will receive, for God will give you His grace and His love in abundance. He will love you very much as you too will love Him very much, because you will stop loving your own self which seeks, page 56, to be nourished with egoism and pride and blueberries that ought to go into a pie for other people, and not with the grace of God, which provides all the vitamins for the soul. You don't need those blueberries that ought to be for other people. And also divine transformation. Those are bad vitamins. Vitamins are bad for you and good for other people. Last paragraph in this section. People usually discard whatever they abhor, whatever they just have disdainful, disgusted by it. But we must realize that the self is abhorrent. It is worthy of being abhorred. It is worthy of recognizing that it's death dealing. It's chains that make you a slave, you know, to the passions, so that you can't act freely as God created us to be and to act. If one does not feel abhorrence, he does not throw it away. I don't want this disgusting thing. If we can feel that way about ourselves instead of loving ourselves, then we can throw it away. To throw out even the old man within you, you must abhor him. Progress cannot be made half-heartedly. We must hate sin. That's what hatred is for. Hatred is a passion that is good. It's not necessarily bad. Hatred is for hating the passions in you, not the passions in other people. You know, we don't get to be, that's self-righteous. I mean, we can have all these passions. In fact, if we have a passion, we're going to notice that passion in everybody else.
That's just torment for you.
We're not going to notice in ourselves and say, look at all these people that are filled with this passion. That passion wouldn't be visible to us in others if we were dealing with that passion in ourselves. And the funny thing happens too, that while when we're busy condemning others for having the passion that is eating us up, in some way it works to make us feel less bad about the fact that that passion is filling us up.
That's why we do it.
Look and, you know, take attention away from ourselves. Build ourselves up with pride. So, Yurunda, page 56, first new section, the second section. How did the saints force their own self? When one surpasses the boundaries of his endurance, you go further than you can do. Go further than I can do. You know, struggling humbly, then we're humble, with Philotima. Then divine supernatural strength comes to us. There's a story on page 57, which is a nice story, and it finishes out this section, but I'm going to pass it by and go on to part two, Pride, the Root of Evil, page number 61, because there's great stuff here, especially for the next couple pages, up to where Sharon's marker is.
Go past my marker.
Yurunda, I am envious, resentful, and condemn and get angry. Envy, condemnation, anger, resentment, and so on all come from pride. Pride is the general of all passions. Pride is the one that has control over all the passions and sends them where they need to go so that they will do the most damage. Or, turn it around, give the most selfish benefit to pride. Pride is the general that tells people where to be resentful. Resent this, it will make you feel much better about yourself. Make you love yourself much more if you are resentful of this person and what they have done or what they have. Oh, there's someone over there that you can condemn that is perfect to make you feel better about yourself. Condemn that person. Pride is the general that sends the soldiers over to do those things. Anger. Oh, look at this situation. Isn't it outrageous? I am so furious. And pride is being served. So in all of these battles to build up pride, pride is the general, and he sends the passions where they will do the most good to self-love, or the most damage to our spiritual lives the way we should be. So if you want to win the battle, take out the general. Then the passions won't know what to do. They'll just kind of pop up and peter out, which is what passions do anyway, left to their own. They don't have a general. to pull them together, to focus them on building up pride, you see. So there may be envy, but it'll come up, it'll peak, it'll go away, you'll forget about it. Same thing with anger. Oh, you know, you get so angry, you know, something distracts you or something else comes along, it goes away. You know, like one of those little dust devils that go around the house, you know, around outside in the summertime. You know, all the leaves go up in a circle and all of a sudden, poof, you know, they fall down. That's how passions are, unless they're directed to some purpose. Building ourselves up with pride. So that's what he means by pride being the general. So our response in the spiritual warfare is to launch a frontal attack against pride. Center of the paragraph. Last line. If the capital city is decimated, that means cut down by 10%. Deci, 10. Cut down by 10%. If the capital city is decimated by a powerful bomb, then the rest of the nation crumbles, and the nation of self-love falls. A prideful person is allied with the devil. The devil yields more easily than a prideful person. Well, there's a revelation. You can make a demon relent if you humble yourself. So demons are vulnerable to humility. Pride makes them stronger. Whereas, even if you humble yourself before a prideful person and ask for a prideful person's forgiveness, not only will the prideful person not yield, but he will snap, "You're being a hypocrite." He will maintain his pridefulness. Because why? Doesn't it build up his pride even more? So what's the matter with you? We are prideful people. Why ask me for forgiveness? I'd rather be more prideful. Forgiveness. Isn't that going to make me humble? That's the last thing the prideful person would do. So the demon will yield to pridefulness. The prideful person won't accept
your apology.
Your apology. He won't give you.
He won't give you forgiveness. No, because it would make him humble.
Call you a hypocrite. You don't really want this forgiveness. You just...
Well, you know, people believe in pride. They believe that that virtual image is really them. And they don't want it to go away.
Preached in churches these days.
The virtual image? Yes, build yourself up. Have pride in yourself.
Right.
Yeah, they do. They do preach that. Well, that's not Christianity. That's mostly that secular humanism. Top of page 62. One who has more humility has more spiritual substance. The prideful person has no inner substance. That's why they hang on to the pride, because that's all they've got. Inside they're hollow, empty. He is hollow, like the unripened stalk of wheat that stands tall because it's rigid, like a hollow tube. How strong is a hollowed stalk of wheat? The ripened stalk bends its little head when it's full with the grain. You know, it will bend over, it won't snap. But the straight, hollow stalk is easily snapped. When there is pride, everything one does is merely a balloon inflated by the devil, who then pierces it with a needle so that it breaks and makes a lot of noise. Somebody finally blows up. I've had it. You know, they're building themselves up. They're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I can't stand it. I can't stand all these people being the way they are. And boom, you know. A lot of noise. Pride is dishonorable. And now, last sentence in the paragraph, it's trying to send us to hell. It's trying to alienate us from God, alienate us from others, so that others are alienated in our presence even. And then it builds us up when they are. And we think, oh boy, they can't stand to be in the presence of this magnificent human being that is me.
They're envious.
They're envious, of course. Of course. Middle section, page 62. The devil often camouflages everything he presents so that one is not aware that pride is at work. We don't even realize that pride is what's happening. A prideful person may not be aware of all the pride that he has. They just think he's valuable. So, well, I can't help other people aren't as good as me. You know, so I'm humble, in fact. I'm humble that I am so much better than other people. He will have a sense of egoistic self-satisfaction. I have heard people claim this as humility. An egoistic sense of self-satisfaction. This is a very twisted point of view, but I've heard it expressed. A prideful person will have a sense of egoistic self-satisfaction. A sense of superiority over others. I don't envy others. I've got it. Yoronda, what happens when a person is not at all aware of having pride? Then spiritual laws work. What he's saying here is that you are completely at the mercy of objective laws, spiritual laws, almost like the law of nature. You drop something from a height, it drops, bang, it hits the floor. You're in an accident, in a car, you're speeding along. It doesn't matter that you are created in the image and likeness of God, that you are a conscious human being. When your car slams up against another car, your body is treated as though it were any other piece of matter in the universe. It isn't, but you are smashed just like anything that doesn't make any difference. You are at the mercy of the natural forces of the world. So these are the spiritual laws. One becomes prideful, he falls and is humbled. Because, after all, you're not God. You know, you build up bigger and bigger with pride, you're going to fall. It can't last forever, no matter what you do. You make a career out of avoiding falling out of pride. Eventually, you will fall. You will be humbled. You'll be humbled in dozens of small ways before others. So you're humbled, but he says something else about it. The prideful person becomes prideful again, and again he falls, and again he's humbled. And this situation goes on and on his entire life. Humility, pride, looks like a cycle. Humility, pride, humility, pride. Such humility, this kind of humility, humility that comes about as a result of a fall from pride, is not a virtue. Humility that comes about as a result of a fall from pride is not a virtue. Top of 63. It is the result of the spiritual laws that are at work. It doesn't change the person. It's not a matter of spiritual consciousness or effort or watchfulness or anything like that. It's just the consequence of being prideful. Pride, being humble in your pride. Pride, being humbled in your pride. In other words, one is humbled against his will and without any spiritual gain. This happens over and over and over and over again. A kind of stagnation occurs as far as your spiritual life is concerned. Stagnant pool. Nothing going on. What if somebody is corrected and they don't understand? Their spiritual guide points out to them they've fallen into pride and they're in a bad situation. But the person doesn't get it. They're just confused, or maybe they think they're being dealt with unfairly or something, or being criticized in an unfair way. They're not open to hearing the correction. They're not open to being corrected in any kind of way. Because, he says, the person's pride has developed scales. And she'll continue to make the same mistakes over and over and over again. Pride, catastrophe. Pride, being humble, you know. But no spiritual gain. No matter what you tell the person, they will continue to believe their own thoughts. So it's like you're caught. It's not like being a conscious person. That's the way unconscious physical bits of matter are dealt with in the world. So there's no freedom, you see?
Is that saying they couldn't understand if they wanted to?
Yeah, they couldn't. They couldn't. They could. They've lost the ability to understand. Their pride has developed scales, so they don't hear the correction.
Even if they do want to.
Well, they don't. I'll try harder.
If they do
want, I will try harder. Mm. I will do it better next time. Not if the problem is one that can only be dealt with by humility or spiritual correction. Not because you're not good enough, so be better at whatever it is you're doing, so you try harder, you're trying out of your pride again. So you've been humbled, now you're going to have pride come back, say, I'm going to try hard this time. This time I'll do it. This time I'll make it crash, you know. Mm. And the spiritual guide tells it, look, the problem is this, that, and the other. I will try harder. They don't hear it. They don't hear the correction. All they hear is that you're telling me I didn't do good. I didn't do good enough. Still self-dependent. Okay, middle of page 65, prideful thoughts. Yolanda, what should we do when prideful thoughts come to us? We should laugh at prideful thoughts, just as others laugh when they see us being prideful. Pride is ridiculous when people see someone being prideful. It's obvious. It makes you the object of ridicule. And of course, you make believe you don't see it and you think badly of them. You just kind of get put your nose a little higher in the air. But what should you do when a prideful thought comes? Look at this ridiculous prideful thought. Laugh at it the way other people would laugh at you if they saw you being prideful in this ridiculous way. Because they do, you know. Do prideful thoughts come to a humble person? Sure they do. But a humble person laughs them off because he knows himself. Look at this ridiculous thought. Just brush it away. Thoughts come. You brush them away instead of them building you up. Yolanda, I have read somewhere that we must dispel a prideful thought immediately, just as we dispel an indecent thought. For most of us, indecent thoughts are pretty easy to deal with, mainly because we respect others, we love others, we treat others as real human beings. And if some thought comes into our mind to think about another human being as though they were just an object to be lusted over by ourselves, we know that that indecent thought is not worthy, and we just brush it away. That's fairly easy for most people to deal with. But Elder Poesios says, the problem is that while an indecent thought is easily recognized, it's indecent, you brush it away, you turn away from it. It takes a great deal of vigilance to recognize a prideful thought. So prideful thoughts are much more difficult to deal with than indecent thoughts. Bottom of the page. Vigilance is required to become aware of prideful thoughts and to dispel them, to dispel the prideful thought. Yolanda, page 66, most of the time a prideful thought comes in no time at all. How will I have the time to bring a humble thought forward? A good thought. Remember past books by Elder Poesios about good thoughts. Some of us are better at them than others. Prideful thoughts come like lightning. You must get a new machine. Here is something that we've heard him talk about in other books. Remember when he talks about, some of us, our mind and our inner life is like a machine that makes bullets. Automatically, we're always making ammunition. Anything that happens, we've always got a stockpile of ammunition. Somebody comes along and needs to be taken down a peg, boom, we're ready. The bullets are always there. Why? Because we have a machine that makes that kind of ammunition. It takes people down right and left. So we need a different machine. We need a machine that makes something besides bullets, something besides attacks, something besides prideful thoughts. If we have a machine that makes prideful thoughts, we will be cranking out prideful thoughts and it could be like a machine gun, a lightning machine gun. Boom, 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 boom. We've got nothing but prideful thoughts. Why? Because we have a machine that makes prideful thoughts. That's what he's saying. So we need to get rid of that machine and get a new machine. One that will enable you to constantly cultivate humble thoughts in order to be quicker. So if you have a stockpile of humble thoughts, you'll be able to respond quickly. Only humble thoughts bring humility, and only with humility does pride go away. So now you know how to do it. We need a humble thought machine, and we're in business. Don't make those prideful thoughts anymore. Put that machine out of business. And if you divest yourself of the old man and you're disgusted by that sort of thing, by that grimy cloak of old manness, get rid of that, get a new machine, you're in business. You're on the road to sainthood. So such is the advice and counsel of St. Elder Paisios. What do you think?
Well, that's the place for the Jesus prayer, right? Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner.
And give me some humble thoughts.
That's what you,
make
that's,
me, make
that's
me a your, humble thought machine.
That's your humble thought there.
Well,
instead of
that's more.
It's a start.
That's more.
Have mercy on me, a sinner.
Instead of saying, you know, instead of the prideful thought.
I remember when he
that's
was,
the easy one to.
Instead of, Lord, lift me up where I belong, where the eagles fly.
There you go.
There's a song like that. Well, lift us up where we
belong. I remember saying, the one time St. Paisios was talking about how he was having to. He was trying to think of a humble thought. And he was comparing himself with the bug, but he dismissed a lot of bugs. He almost said he was even with the dung beetle, because he at least takes his pile of dung to confession. There's one of his.
Okay, next time.
Chapter 2, pride is multi, how is that, multifarious?
Multifarious, has many forms.
That's page 67.
Yes.
Okay.
67 next time.